This morning's Old Testament reading is from the book of Exodus, chapter 1, verses 22 through chapter 2, verse 10. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, "Every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live." Now, a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him 3 months. When she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the riverbank. And his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. Now, the daughter of Pharaoh came to bathe at the river while her young women walked beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her servant woman, and she took it. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby was crying. She took pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call you a nurse from the Hebrew woman to nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the girl went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. When the child grew older, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses because, she said, "I drew him out of the water." This morning's reading from the Acts of the Apostles comes from Acts chapter 27, verses 13 to 15, 20 to 24, and 44. Now, when the south wind blew gently, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, they weighed anchor and sailed along Crete, close to the shore. But soon, a tempestuous wind called the Northeaster struck down from the land, and when the ship was caught and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and were driven along. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope of our being saved was at last abandoned. Since they had been without food for a long time, Paul stood up among them and said, "Men, you should have listened to me and not have set sail from Crete and incurred this injury and loss. Yet now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night there stood before me an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I worship. And he said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. And behold, God has granted you all those who sail with you.' And so it was that all were brought safely to land." The word of the Lord.
The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Mark. Glory to you, Lord Christ. On that day, when evening had come, he said to them, "Let's go across to the other side." And leaving the crowd, they took him with them in the boat, just as he was. And other boats were with him. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking into the boat, so that the boat was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" And he awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. He said to them, "Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?" And they were filled with great fear and said to one another, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" The Gospel of the Lord.
Praise be to you, Lord Christ.
Well, good morning, friends, and happy summer, and welcome to All Saints as we continue our sermon series, Echoes of Exodus. Well, in 1973, the average size of a home in America was 1,525 square feet. But 40 years later, in 2013, the average house size had almost doubled to nearly 2,600 square feet. But in the past few years, some people have been choosing to go smaller. We've seen this in the emergence of tiny houses. These homes are usually less than 500 square feet and that have been popularized in these reality shows such as Tiny House Nation and Tiny House Hunters. And the question is, why tiny houses? And surely some people build them for economic reasons. After the Great Recession, people can no longer afford to buy or build larger homes. But then surely some people also do so for environmental reasons, hoping to minimize as much as possible their carbon footprint. But my hunch is that some people build and move into tiny houses for existential reasons. They do so because they need a place. They need somewhere cozy and warm, somewhere manageable and intimate, in order to feel safe from the storms of life. In our reading in Exodus today, we see that the storms of life have reached the Israelites, these people living on the physical waters of the Nile, in which the metaphorical waters are rising around them. And amidst the chaos of the waters, they need somewhere to go. They need somewhere to be safe. And it's no different for the people of God today. In life's chaos, we need somewhere to go, and we need somewhere to be safe. The only question is where? Where do you go when the waters rise? That's our question for this morning. What we're going to see this morning is that the answer throughout the scriptures is go to the boat. It is always the boat. So two things this morning. One, our need for the boat, and second, our life on the boat. First, our need for the boat. Well, the book of Exodus begins rather calmly. You'll remember that at the end of Genesis, Joseph moves to Egypt. And here at the beginning of Exodus, we see that his family and his offspring have spread far and wide. And it appears that God's plan for Israel, for Joseph's family, is going smoothly. But then the waters begin to rise. And it all begins with a new king in Egypt who, the text says, quote, did not know Joseph. In other words, he doesn't care about God's plan for Israel. And so he does a couple of things. First, he enslaves Israel. He sets up taskmasters over Israel in order to afflict them and make them build cities. And the lives of the Hebrews, Exodus says, become bitter and hard. But then secondly, he vows to murder the Israelites, to kill any Hebrew males that are born. And so the land of Egypt has become a land of slavery and a land of terror. The waters have risen, and that's where we pick up the story at the end of chapter 1, where it says, then Pharaoh commanded all the people, every son that is born of the Hebrews you shall cast into the Nile. And into this world we meet a particular Levite woman in chapter 2, verse 1, a woman who probably prayed to have a daughter, but had a son. And like any mother, she loves the son. She wants the son to be saved, so she hides her son. But in verse 2-3, we see that she has reached the point of no return. Because the reality is, you can only hide a baby for so long. And she sees that she must let the baby go, or else he will die. And I imagine many of you feel like this woman this morning in one way or another, because the waters of the Nile have risen fast around you, and they made their way even to your doorstep. And life does feel desperate and chaotic, like it does for this woman. For some of you, the waters of life have taken the form of water itself. Many of our congregants have families whose lives were devastated by Harvey last fall. But for others of you, the waters have taken the form of death. Positive pregnancy tests that ended in miscarriage. Husband or a wife or a parent that you've lost to cancer. Disease decaying your body. Alzheimer's decaying the mind of someone you love. Our congregation has faced all of these things in the last year. For others of you, maybe it isn't death, but it's taskmasters. You feel enslaved by bosses or spouses or in-laws who directly oppose you, who it seems that God has placed in your life for the sole purpose of making you miserable. Others of you are enslaved by more subtle taskmasters, workaholism, alcoholism, other forms of addiction, things that promise you purpose or control in your life but never fail to make your life bitter and hard. Regardless of what form the waters take, we all know what it's like to feel forgotten by God, nostalgic for a time when he felt near, and doubtful whether a time such as that will come again. And when these waters rise, the question again is, where do you go? Because in our world, there are many places you can go. You can go to the gym and bring order to your body. You can go to the office and feel productive again. Not to mention the obvious places, the bar, the strip club, the casino. But nowadays, you don't even have to leave the house. There are virtual places you can go, right? You can go to your cell phone and tune out for a while. You can go to the computer. You can go to pornography. Or there are relationships. If you feel alone in your marriage, you find comfort in your kids. There's no doubt that in this world, some shelters are healthier than others. A friend who cares about you, a loving spouse or parent. But it seems that even these things in this world, no shelter seems to fully do the trick for us. So where does this Levite woman in Exodus 2 go? What does she do when the waters rise? Well, she makes a boat. Verse 3, when she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket, made of bulrushes, and daubed it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the riverbank. And now, it's easy for us to be sentimental about this story, but these are desperate times for Israel, and this is no ordinary basket. Because what we see is that the Hebrew word translated basket here only appears one other time in the Old Testament. And it's the same word for the ark in Genesis 6. In that story, God is going to drown the world, so he commands Noah to make an ark. And here in Exodus 2, Moses is going to drown in the river, so his mother makes an ark. In other words, just as God made an ark to deliver his people from the waters of the flood in Genesis 9, he makes an ark to deliver Moses from the waters of the Nile here in Exodus 2. So Genesis is echoed by Exodus. So is it any wonder that both of these passages are echoed by our gospel reading? Because if you look down at Mark 4, you'll see that God's people are once again in dangerous waters. The storm is raging upon the lake, and Jesus, God in the flesh, doesn't just appear asleep, but he is asleep. The boat is filling fast with water, and the disciples have reached their breaking point. So what do? They wake up Jesus, and they ask him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" But once more, it turns out that the boat is actually the safest place that the disciples can be, because that is where Jesus is. So where does that leave us? What is the boat for us, the people of God, today? Well, in March, Emily and I got to go to Paris. And any of you who know me well know that I'm a huge Francophile, that I love all things French. So even though I sold this trip to my wife as her getting to go to France for the first time, really the trip was about me. And so we go to Paris, and on our trip we got to visit the most famous church in the world, Notre Dame, which, as you know, sits on an island in the middle of the River Seine. And perhaps you've noticed yourself that Notre Dame looks a lot like a ship. On the outside, you have the flying buttresses protruding out towards the river like oars from a boat. And on the inside, it's as if you're hunkered down the stern of a ship as the nave rises above you, that word nave coming from the Latin word for boat. And this is no accident, because as the author Robert Barron points out, the medieval architects endeavored to make the cathedrals look like great ships. For the idea, he writes, is that the church is Noah's Ark, moving through the stormy waters of sin, the place of safety in which sinners have been called. So the church is our boat. The church is what we need as the people of God today in order to survive life's storms, because Jesus is in the boat. And yet rarely do people, even those who identify as Christians, head to the boat in times of crisis. And we need to ask why that is. I think there are at least a couple of reasons. First of all, many of us feel that the church is unnecessary. The writer and professor Hans Boersma said that the overall attitude among evangelicals continues to regard church as belonging to the well-being rather than to the very being of the Christian life. In other words, we tend to think of church like having a gym membership. It's good for you to go, but it's not the end of the world if you don't. You can always do some sit-ups and push-ups at home. In the same way, we think it's good if I go to church because I know I'll hear and learn about Jesus there, but I can always listen to a sermon online. I can always turn on Hillsong and listen to some songs. But the New Testament does not speak of the church as optional, but as essential. It says that if you're a Christian, the church isn't just something you associate with, but it's actually something you participate in. If you've been baptized into the church, you're built into the very fabric of the church. To continue the metaphor, it is as if you are a plank in the boat. And this is why I often tell our middle and high school students that I love it if you come to youth group on Sunday night, but I would much rather you come to church on Sunday mornings. Because on Sunday mornings, you participate fully in the body. You take communion, you see baptisms, you see people younger and older than you, weaker and stronger than you, people who God has purposely placed in your life for you to learn from and for you to love. So maybe you're a Christian, yet you don't go to church or become a member of a church because you feel it's unnecessary. But maybe you're here and you're not a Christian, and you don't want to go to church because you feel it's unsafe. You think the church is too homogenous. It feels like everyone is white, middle to upper middle class, or whatever it might be. Or else you think that church is too judgmental. That it feels like everyone's got their lives put together on the inside and out. It's as if they're sizing you up. It's as if they're going to leave and walk out the door talking to someone else about you, what you're wearing. It seems as if you don't look good or act good, the church is not for you. Others of you think the church is too authoritative. Feels like the church has too much power, it's too institutional, it too easily aligns itself with a political party, it just wants your money. You've heard too many stories in the newspaper about churches who have misused their power, or perhaps you've been a victim of this misuse yourself. And all of these things can be and have been too true. And yet Christ died for the boat, he died for all its judgmentalness, all its abuses, and Christ is determined to make the boat a place that is safe and a place of rest. And in time, he will do that. But in the meantime, he is with us in the boat. The boat is where Christ is. It is his bride, and he is united to it in love. So we see first this morning that the claim of Christianity is that the church is the only place to go for shelter from the storms of life, because the church is where Jesus is. So if the church is our boat, we need to look secondly at life on the boat. We need to set expectations. If the boat is going to be my place, what exactly does life on the boat entail? And to answer this question, we need to look back at our readings, especially at our Acts reading. Well, in light of everything we've seen so far, it should be no surprise to find Paul and the apostles, the very founders of the church, on a boat. But far from being docked safely in some harbor, their boat is adrift and is being driven along by a strong northeastern wind. And to make matters worse, things are tense on the boat. They're tense between Paul and his shipmates, who didn't listen to him when he told them not to set sail from Crete. And food is running out on the boat, and so is hope. And friends, this is what life in the church often feels like. If God didn't spare Paul and the apostles from the stormy seas, from times of despair, from times of fighting with one another, then surely he doesn't spare us from the same things today. Life on the boat is rocky. It's rocky because of both what's outside the boat and what's inside the boat. Because outside the boat, the waves and the storms of life persist. The world doesn't stop when we get on the boat. We continue to feel the waves of life beneath us. Times when it seems that God doesn't care that we are perishing. Times when we don't like what is happening in our city or in our country or in our church or in our home. But the boat is also rocky because of what's inside the boat. The boat is rocky because there are other sinners inside the boat. And the boat is rocky because you are on the boat. See, on boats, other people's stuff becomes our stuff and vice versa. If someone gets sick on a boat, you might get sick as well. If someone's life falls apart on the boat, you might actually be the one who has to come and restore them. And then there's the fighting. I've often wondered about Noah and his family on the ark. Surely they fought, right? Like, if your family fights on a four-hour beach road trip to Port Aransas, like, surely Noah and his family fought when they were shut up in a boat for 40 days and 40 nights. And so it should be no surprise that our church family will have its tensions as well, that life on the boat will be rocky. But however rocky it gets, the boat is still en route. In all of our stories this morning, we see that the boat is going somewhere, that it has a purpose. Look back at verse 10 of our Exodus reading. When the child grew up, his mother brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she named him Moses because, she said, I drew him up out of the water. Friends, what we see is that this event in Moses' life, this event of being delivered from the chaos of the Nile, it becomes his very name. It becomes his purpose. It becomes the truest thing about him, that he has been drawn up in order to draw others up. And that's what happens in the rest of Exodus. As the authors of our Echoes of Exodus book put it, Exodus 2 is Moses' Exodus experience. Moses is delivered through a basket in the Nile so that he may one day deliver Israel out of slavery. And the same is true of Noah. He and his family are delivered in the ark so that life may once again persist in a world of death. Or the disciples, they are purposely brought by Jesus into the storm and then delivered from the storm so that they might put their faith in him and follow him throughout the land of Judea, along with him casting out demons and healing the blind, and turning tears once more into laughter. Or the Apostle Paul. He is delivered from the storm so that he may stand before Caesar and preach the gospel to Rome. Well, Jack Schumacher is a 57-year-old man in Houston with salt and pepper hair and an unassuming face, and also a 17-foot fishing boat. And so when Hurricane Harvey made landfall last fall, here's what happened. Schumacher began getting phone calls in the middle of the night. He got a call from an elderly woman in a wheelchair in a one-story home. He got a call from another neighbor with a mother in hospice care on the bottom story. And as his wife fielded all these phone calls, Schumacher would set out in his boat. He would head out into the stormy waters and bring others to safety so that by the end of the storm, Jack had ensured that around 25 of his neighbors were safe. And I don't tell this story for the sake of telling a hero story, but as a sign of the gospel. Because if you're a Christian and if you have been delivered from sin and death, this is you. You are now en route. You have been called into the boat in order to bring others in. You have been delivered from sin and death and despair in order to deliver others from whatever form those things might take. In other words, you are each en route on some mission in your life. And I know this to be true because I've seen it to be true in just my short time here. I've seen so many of you in this body resisting death and resisting evil and resisting despair in so many ways. Whether it's through your parenting, or through the way you chase and love the lonely, or whether you keep showing up for work even when your work feels purposeless or monotonous, regardless of who you are and regardless of how insignificant you might feel in this church or in this city, this congregation needs you and your neighbors need you. Well, perhaps the most famous book ever written about the Christian life is John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. One projection says that it is perhaps the sixth best-selling book of all time. There's a seminary professor in Toronto who loves to read the Pilgrim's Progress for the same reasons that many of you read it and read it to your children, because of its beautiful depiction of the mountains and the valleys of the Christian life. But this seminary professor, he says if it had been him, he would have made one small revision to the book. He says, instead of Christian making his pilgrimage by foot, Christian should have been in a boat. And it's a bold claim to mess with Pilgrim's Progress, but perhaps it's not misguided. Because as we've seen this morning, one of Scripture's favorite ways to picture God's deliverance of his people and the mission for his church is by a boat. It's by a ship. And throughout the history of the church, people have always seen the church as a type of ship guiding us through the stormy waters of this life. And so, friends, here we are this morning in the boat together, about to head out and live another week in this beautiful but broken world. And as we do, here's the good news of the gospel. Jesus is with us in the boat, and one day he will guide us off the boat safe and sound. We know this to be true because after Noah and his family had been trapped in the boat for 40 days, they got out. And God promised never to flood the whole world again. And Moses, he was drawn safely from the basket. And the Israelites, we will see in Exodus that they are guided safely through the Red Sea. The disciples in Mark 4 made it safely to land. And Paul in Acts 27 safely reached Rome. And most importantly, Jesus himself, after being laid dead in the tomb for 3 days, safely emerged into the light of Easter morning. And friends, that's why one day, when Christ's redemption of the world is complete and the storms of life have passed, we who have been united to Christ in his death and his resurrection will get off the boat and we'll all live together safely in God's new earth. Amen.